Hey, this is J.D. Webb. I want to apologize for what you're about to hear. My mouse died right at the beginning of the show. We managed to get the show off the ground, the intro and everything was live. But when I went to start the encoder, my mouse was dead, and I was frantically trying to change batteries and get the darn thing working again. So we're lucky that we were able to get what we did get. Chris was just introduced. He's talking about the Heart Murmur. It's a knockoff on Ken Schramm's Heart of Darkness, Melomel. So please enjoy the show. And, hey, I promise we will do better next time.
Honey would go well with those fruit flavors. And through the course of experimenting with this thing, I found out that there were some techniques that needed to be done that were a little bit out of the ordinary and not things that you might consider basic mead-making skills. But then again, it's not really that difficult either. You just got to know when to do them and how to manage the fermentation. So what I'm doing, I've got the final iteration of this thing now is in an aging vessel. It'll be there for a few months. I'm going to taste it. I'm going to make sure that everything is where I want it to be. And then we'll be posting up the recipe and along with complete detailed instructions on how you can make it yourself. And I'll see if I can get JD to post that on the Mead House, and I'll post it on all the other forums that I come across and anywhere that we can find a place to put it to get it out there. And if you follow the instructions, hopefully it'll turn out good for you. And you may learn some new mead making techniques in the process and learn some things that yeast can do that maybe you thought they couldn't do.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, I don't want to jump the gun on that, but Chris, I'm just so interested to learn more about the process that you followed. You know, do you ferment the fruit in the primary, or is it added during the secondary fermentation? And so many questions to ask about that.
Well, all of my fruit goes in primary. Some spices and things may go in secondary on methaglins. I typically put all my fruit up front in primary. That's another thing that I want to discuss in some upcoming shows, some ways to, you know, I hear people say, I want to put fruit in secondary because I want more fruit character. Well, that's not necessarily the case. You can put fruit in primary and get tons of fruit character. But there are some fermentation techniques that you can do to enhance that. And also something as simple as just how much fruit you put in. You can't put 2 pounds of fruit per gallon in primary and get tons of fruit character most of the time. You gotta load the thing up with fruit and you gotta follow the right procedures. In some upcoming episodes, I would like to discuss some of these things, and one of the subjects that is going to be really important is going to be the oxidative and reductive ferments, and I'd like to talk about that in an upcoming episode, and we'll compare the two. When should you use them? When should you avoid them? How do you use them? A little bit about what they do, and I'll even try to give you a recipe and a little experiment that you can do, maybe with a side-by-side 1 gallon batches, and you can taste the difference for yourself.
Yeah, that sounds good. I skipped right over part of our opening course. This is about how relaxed this show is. We have a call-in number. If you want to call the show, the number is 818-921-4680. Let's do that again, J.D. 818-92. You know, and I've done this damn many times in the past. This should be old hat. The number, 818-921-4680, the Mead House radio show. Feel free to give us a holler. If we're talking about something that piques your interest, give us a call, and we'll be glad to have you join in on the conversation with us. But, yeah, you know, Chris is talking about something that, I learned here a while back about this, you know, putting fruit in, you know, doing a melomel. And I've heard it be told by quite a few people that more is better. And that, you know, you read recipes online, and so many of them say, you know, anywhere from 2.5 to 3 pounds per gallon is what you should use. Yet, you know, you talk to people like Pete Bakalich, and he says, you know, the more is better. So if you can go 4 or 5 pounds per gallon, you know, that's much better.
Yeah, well, I'll give you a little hint. The Heart Murmur has got 7 pounds per gallon of fruit.
7 pounds.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing that you have to be concerned about with the fruit is displacement. And maybe later on down the line, you know, when we get things rolling on the show here, I'll talk more about the failed pumpkin experiment. I don't want to go into all the details right now, but Chris knows exactly what I'm talking about. He was with me from the start of it. But, you know, from the very beginning, I mean, I'm thinking 27 pounds of roasted, you know, pumpkin. And that's a lot of pumpkin. Okay, I don't care what anybody says. That's a lot of pumpkin. Well, I have a 7 gallon stainless steel fermenter that I use. So when I went to put that 27 pounds in, I had to take out about almost 2 gallons of must in order to fill, you know, to drop that pumpkin in because of displacement. So if you're thinking, you know, like Chris, he's doing 7 pounds a gallon fruit up front to primary, keep that in the back of your mind that fruit is going to have to replace, you know, the liquid in your container. So make sure you've got a big enough container that's going to handle.
Well, I'll give you another little teaser on this thing. The fruit does never go into the primary fermentation bucket. When I first started this experiment, I was juicing all this fruit. And if you've never tried to juice 18 pounds of raspberries, you need to try it one time. my kitchen looked like somebody had been brutally murdered in there by the time
I
got
to juice. I can just imagine.
Oh, my God. So I found a way to do it. That I did on this last batch, it worked really well. I got just about all the juice you could get out, so I never put any pulp or seeds or anything in the primary. It was all juice. So I will admit there are easier ways to do it, and I will give you that option in the recipe when I get it put out there. But I like doing it this way, and it's not all that difficult. It just takes a little extra time to do. I found a great, great product that I'll be introducing you to as well.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, looking forward to hearing about that. And I'll tell you, I have just done a handful of melomels myself, and only one of those melomels did I use fresh fruit. The others I've used, what is it, the Vintner's Harvest, the canned fruit purees. I've done some peach batches and a cherry one, but the one time I used fresh fruit, it was with some local raspberries that my wife and I went and picked at a local farm here, you know, up north of Milwaukee, and just I ran into some issues as well. Now I added those fruits to the secondary fermenter, and you know, we had frozen them, you know, a day or two in advance to help kind of break down those cell walls and help the juice extraction during the secondary fermentation. But all of my fermentation vessels are glass carboys with those, you know, small necks up right. at the top and trying to force. I think we probably used about 9 pounds of raspberries, and trying to force those through that tiny little hole up at the top was mm-hmm. not the most fun experience. And then trying to get them yep. back out afterwards, that wasn't too
it's
fun either.
Good. That's a good reason to use buckets to ferment in, and it's a good reason to put them in primary.
yep. Gonna have to invest in a nice bucket one of these days.
My first experience with making mead in large quantities, you know, was a 5-gallon batch of a takeoff of Joe's Ancient Orange, but I didn't use the Fleischmann's yeast. I used D47. And I cut the oranges up, and you know, like you're saying, forced them through the neck of the. And that's the last time I ever fermented in a glass jug. So I mean, you know, when yep. it was all done, trying to pull those cut up oranges out of the damn carboy, I was ready to take the carboy downstairs and just put it in the dumpster and start over.
So. I believe, well, you know, this brings up. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying. I believe that.
Oh yeah, my first two batches were in carboys, and I haven't fermented in a carboy since that time. But I'm glad you brought this up, because I was mentioning oxidative and reductive ferments that I'm going to talk about in another episode. That's another good reason to use a bucket, because you've got full control over that. And you'll understand more about it when we get to. I'm purposely teasing you to get you to listen again. So
you are, Chris. I'll tell you, these are new terms for me: oxidative and reductive ferments. So you're telling me I have to wait for another show after this?
Yeah, everybody's got to come back.
Yep, he's pretty good at this. Yeah,
I'll say.
Well, I just, you know. That first batch, I'm finally drinking the stuff. Of course, at the time, I didn't know anything about temperature control. I mean, all the recipes that you read on, you know, all these websites, the homesteaders and preppers, and they put up all these great recipes, you know. But what they don't tell you, they don't tell you anything about nutrients. They don't tell you anything about, you know, temperature controls and that kind of thing. So that first batch, when it all cleared, you know, we took a sip, and I mean, I probably could have sold it as lighter fluid to all my neighbors. It was that toxic. But I thought, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and bottle this stuff up. Well, that was over a year ago. In fact, it's over a year old. It's a year and, I don't know, 4 or 5 months old now. And now it's starting to come around. It's finally starting to taste like a Chardonnay type wine. You know, it's not, there's no sweetness to it, just very, very, very slight on the tongue when you first put it in your mouth. But I'm kind of liking it, you know. But of course, I mean, it had to sit for a year, so.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry, Chris, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that works sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess, if I were to go back and count up the gallons of honey that I've poured down the garbage disposal of all the failed attempts at making mead, you know, I'm sure I could probably stock a small store, but... you know, I mean, how many times you got to do this before you get it right and, you know, finally get on to some good information that kind of...
And that's why people need to listen to the show, because we pour honey down the drain so you don't have to.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, that sounds like a slogan.
Yeah.
And, write that down, will you?
Let's remember that.
We pour honey down the drain so you don't have to. But yeah, I mean, I think we've all been there, done that. I want to introduce Jeff Strauss. Jeff, joining us here tonight on the show, he posted up this deal. And before we talk about that, Jeff, he posted up this experiment that he's doing with nutrients and whatnot. And I found it quite interesting. So we're going to let Jeff talk about that for a minute. But Jeff, go back to the first, your first batches. How many of them went down the garbage disposal?
Well, not a lot of them have gone down the garbage disposal, but that may just be that I have a tolerance for some not so great mead too.
Totally agree.
A lot of my experiments here have been like with little 1 gallon batches that aren't terribly heartbreaking to lose either. So, I've tried some that just did not pan out. We had we actually tried a saffron at one time that I thought would be amazing if I could get that delicate saffrony flavor with a kind of a semi-dry mead, and it did not succeed at all. It was just ridiculously terrible.
Well, I think that's the unique thing about making mead is, it's honey and water and yeast and whatever in the hell else you can think of to throw in there to come up with an interesting, tasty flavor. And I think that's the cool thing about fermenting mead.
I absolutely agree with you there.
It's almost like the beer. Now, I love my craft beer. I love my craft beer. I will never drink another Miller, Coors, Sab. You know what I mean?
Budweiser.
Well, I don't know about Pabst. I might drink another Pabst. But it was a profound experience when I had my first craft beer to the point where I thought, damn, I'm drinking beer for the first time, and I'm like 40 years old. More than that, 50 years old. And it was a very profound experience. And then now when I go to the shelf, I'm looking at stuff that's like, peanut butter milk stout, marshmallow orange lime, and mead is kind of the same way. I mean, and that's what's cool about it. You can experiment until your heart's content to come up with something that, actually tastes pretty good.
And when you find the right recipe that you love, you can always rest assured that you'll always have a surprise every time you make it, because you cannot duplicate it any more than you can duplicate a batch of wine. Every year, the grapes are going to have a different characteristic because of the amount of rainfall, when they were harvested, the length of the growing season, how much nutrient is in the soil. And if you think that wine has a variation, think about mead for a moment. Not only is honey different from one blossom to the next, but it's also different from one area of the country to the next, and it's even different from season to season. And you've got a beehive out here, and you go take the honey, and you go back in 4, 5, 6 months and take the honey again from that same hive is going to be different.
Yeah.
It's never the same. You're never going to make the same mead twice.
Yeah, orange blossom honey from out here in California certainly tastes different than the orange blossom honey in Florida. And then the orange blossom honey from year to year out here tastes different. And of course, California being, we've just gone through a drought, a drought out here that has left a lot of our agriculture just, high and dry. So, and I'm wondering how that's going to affect the honey production, in the future here too. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And, it's so amazing. But the differences in all these honeys, that's one reason why everyone needs to learn how to taste the honey, how to smell the honey. And through the experience, you will eventually get to a point where you know what that honey is going to do in a mead. Now, I will admit, I'm not there yet. I'm better than I used to be, but everyone's going to have something that they're very sensitive to, and they're going to have something that they're not good at detecting. For me, I happen to be very sensitive to anything that's herbaceous or green, grass-tasting type flavors. If it has bitterness, if it has a sourness to it, I'm very sensitive to those things. So that, I guess that's a good thing for me when I'm choosing honey, because you don't want that in a honey most of the time for mead. Right. So a good honey that's good for the table, to put on biscuits, to put on your waffles or whatever, may not necessarily be good for mead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I have found that happens, anything that's in that honey is going to get concentrated when you ferment it. So if it has a slight bitterness to it, once it's fermented, it's going to have a lot of bitterness to it. It just concentrates it and brings it out.
It's funny. Funny how that works. You know, you take your first taste of it and it's like, wow, this tastes really amazing. But then when you ferment it all out and everything, it's like, whoa, where'd that come from?
Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to learn to train your palate to look past the sweetness, because that's the primary thing in honey. And then when you ferment it, that's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And exactly. So and that's difficult to do. And I'm by no means good at it yet. Better than I was.
You know, I know some people who may be listening to the show who heard me on the other show talking about that wildflower honey. Yeah, I'm going to mention it again. Now, I sent a gallon of that wildflower honey down to Mississippi, down to Chris. Now, Chris, you smelled and you tasted. Did that stuff taste like it smelled? I mean, did you get
not
that
necessarily?
Scent?
No, not really. What I got a very in the aroma of that honey, it was very malty. Almost had a little bit of sorghum or molasses type aroma.
Yeah.
But the flavor was very, very floral. It had no herbaceous character. It had no green grass, sour, bitter, milkweed type flavors. Yeah. It was all wildflower. It just tasted like flowers. Yeah. And that's a perfect example of what you're looking for in a wildflower honey. And it was one of the sweetest honeys I've ever tasted. I don't know what the sugar level was in that honey, but it had to be the sweetest honey I've ever tasted.
Yeah. I mean, I just, you know, I don't know how to taste honey yet. Of course, I really haven't sat down and gone through that whole process. Aaron's got this, he's got an experiment. This is probably the appropriate time. Aaron, you've got this experiment going with different varietals of honey going on. Talk to us about that. What do you got going there?
Absolutely. Well, let me just preface it by saying I'm kind of new to this whole concept of tasting honey before it goes into the mead and seeing how that initial flavor translates to the finished product. So with this particular experiment, that was definitely one of the things that I wanted to focus on, was taking some tasting notes of the honey beforehand. And just recently, over this past weekend, I racked it from primary to secondary and took some tasting notes afterwards as well. So this particular experiment, I'm comparing four different honey varietals: a cranberry blossom, a blueberry blossom, raspberry blossom, and then a sunflower blossom as well. So, like I say, I'm kind of new to the process and this concept of tasting honey. So some of the notes I took down are probably pretty simple and may not be using just the right terminology just yet. But the cranberry...
It's all right. We'll get there.
Yeah, exactly. It's a learning process, and you know, just I'm just excited to be learning here. So
what yeast did you use for these, Aaron?
It's a great question. So initially, I wanted to test out some ale yeasts. So initially I pitched the US05, is it the Cefal ale yeast? And after about 48 hours, I might have gotten a little premature here, but after, well, the first 24 hours, there was absolutely no sign of fermentation. And in my experiences with dry ale yeast, you know, in beer, usually within 24 hours, it just shoots off like a rocket. So, you know, after that first 24 hours, I was a little bit worried that, that something might not be going quite right. So I pitched another batch of the US05. 24 hours later, still absolutely no sign of activity at all. So at that point, I pitched some D47 in there. Now, the starting gravity or the bricks on these was 25, which, you know, I'm not quite sure. It might be just a little high for that ale yeast. But once I pitched the D47, it just took off.
I guess I'm going to have to learn bricks after all, too.
Is that about 11, 18 or so, 11, 20, somewhere around in there?
Yeah, I think it's 11.05, 11.10, kind of around in that area, I think.
Okay, yeah, okay.
So
we're working with D47.
We're working with D47, yep.
Okay.
Well, after pitching the Cefal 05, right?
That's right. And I was going to say, unless somehow that ale yeast was able to colonize in there and maybe it took off just a couple of days, but I just suspect it's D47 that actually
D47 ate it.
Yeah.
Cannibalistic damn thing.
Guarantee you the D47 took it over completely.
I would not doubt it. That's definitely what I suspect happened.
So yeah. It started fermenting.
And even I'll back up just a second here to talk about just some of the tastes of these different honeys. So the cranberry one was very rich. It was probably the richest of the four. Chris, I heard you use the word malty over another honey. I think it was the wildflower, kind of a sorghum type flavor. And this cranberry definitely had that pre-fermentation. The blueberry one was a little bit like I described it as round and kind of flat, not really much acidity and just, you know, very, very kind of neutral. The raspberry one was surprisingly floral with just kind of a nice medium sweetness. And then the sunflower one was really interesting. When I actually picked these honeys up, the lady that I was buying it from said that it had almost a metallic flavor. I didn't really get the metallic flavor from it, but it was very bright and acidic, crisp, and almost tart.
Kind of a mineral quality?
I could see that. Maybe a little bit of a mineral type of quality to it. It was also the lightest in color of the bunch too, just a bright, almost straw gold color to it. Huh. So the meads, you know, they went through, they fermented, and I will also say, in the past, I have, like we've kind of been talking about, I've made my fair share of rocket fuel that I've never really been able to achieve just that level of quality that I've really been shooting for. And I did a few things differently throughout the fermentation this time. And I have to say, it just really translated very well to the finished product. Before this batch, I came across this website, meadmaderight.com. And Jeff, I think this is one of the nutrients that you are incorporating into your experiment there as well. But the Fermade O and the organic nitrogen. So this was my first time using organic nitrogen and the Fermade O. It was also my first time following that protocol of degassing the mead 2 times per day. I also, was sure to keep the temperatures in control here. I'll tell you, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the wintertime down here in my basement, it doesn't really get above 65 degrees and probably averages more, like 63 most of the time. So pretty optimal temperatures there. And trying to think if there was
Aaron,
anything
else. If you hang around us for very long, all these things you've mentioned are going to be what you consider standard practice.
That's right. That's right.
Yes.
It's just part of the process, exactly, to making quality mead. So, I also invested in a couple other things. I got one of these pH meters, one of these E-Tech City pH meters. Didn't really need it. All of the pH levels for these started out above 4 and just barely dropped under, the 3.9 range or so throughout the course of fermentation. So never needed to add any buffering like potassium bicarbonate or anything like that. And really had a pretty clean fermentation up until, this past weekend when I racked it. So while I was racking it, I took some samples and was just extremely pleased with what came out. I felt like these meads, after about a month of primary fermentation, already were cleaner, smoother, and just more palatable in such a short time than several of the other batches that I've done that have been aging for anywhere from 1 to 6 years. So I'm just real excited about this Tasna regimen here. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the flavors after fermentation, it was really interesting. The cranberry has a very strong, just a honey aroma. And what's interesting is like the upfront taste that you get is very tart and sour, almost like a cranberry. I would say that initial flavor there for the cranberry blossom most closely resembles the fruit of the blossom of all the four batches. But what's interesting then is the aftertaste finishes very malty, almost the way I would describe it is like a raw unboiled malt extract for anyone who's ever, used malt extract in home brewing beer. Just another interesting thing about that one is just the color. It turned out to be almost like a brilliant shade of red, also very closely resembling the cranberries as well.
Like an Irish red ale or something?
That's actually a really good comparison for that, like a Killian's or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you took these dry. D47 would have taken that, should have taken it dry.
Yep, it took it down to about, the Brix level was 10 for both the cranberry and blueberry, and then 9 for the raspberry and sunflower, which translates to about like a 1.001. So really, really pretty dry.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm just going to have to do this. Google Brix.
JD, go get your hydrometer. You got a triple scale hydrometer. It should be on there.
This is quicker. I mean, everywhere I go now, people talking Brix. I started making wine too, kit wines, and I got a Pinot Noir going. My wife she loves Pinot Noir, so I got a batch of Pinot Noir with a bag of blackberries in it for her. So. And everything, I go to the winemaking talk forum over there, which is probably the premier home winemaking forum. And everybody talks Brix or whatever when it comes to wine. So I just I got to get into that mode. So.
And what a good
husband. I'm stuck on the specific gravity. Go ahead.
Oh, just what a good husband making that blackberry Pinot Noir.
But when you're fermenting, had you already known about temperature control and that kind of thing? What was the area that you were fermenting in? What kind of area?
So it's just down in my basement here. My basement is kind of segmented out into like a semi-finished area with carpet and then an unfinished area as well. So the unfinished area is kind of my meat experimentation area where I've got all my equipment, and that's also where I do the fermentation, where it,
so you know, it stays pretty cool.
Absolutely, yeah. That's cool. About 63. So, just, you know, one other thing. The one that I'm the most excited about is the sunflower blossom. The smell of this, it smells like apple juice, and it just tastes really? Like liquid. Yeah, it just tastes like liquid sunshine too. Kind of that bright tart flavor that you get, almost a little sharpness from the original honey, just carried through, but it picked up even like an apple flavor as well. It's really interesting, almost like a tart apple, like a Granny Smith almost. So really excited about that batch too.
Yeah, I've got a sourwood honey here that has a lot of apple character to it, just in the honey itself, and I'm hoping that comes through in the finished mead.
That's actually, as soon as we get back from North Carolina, that's going to be the next batch that we put together, Chris, is that sourwood.
Yeah, you're going to like it. You're going to like it. I'll send you my notes on that as well. And we'll post, you know, I don't want to turn this into a private conversation either, because we got listeners out here. All of this stuff I'm going to get to JD that I'm mentioning, and we'll post it up so everyone can see what we're talking about, and you can do it yourself. So.
Yeah, absolutely. We can throw it up on the Mead House website, themeadhouse.com. And, you know, keep some notes up there, and, you know, people interested. And this is what it's all about for us. This is why we're doing the show, is to be able to share information, share experiences, talk to people, and get input from other people who have done this, or even people who are wanting to do this, but don't know where to begin. We all had to start somewhere, and we're all still.
Yeah. Learning.
Oh.
And I want to try to do a recipe of the week if we can, or maybe it may turn into a recipe of the month. I don't know, but I was going to have one ready for tonight, but needless to say, I got a little bit sidetracked.
No, yeah.
So I'll try to get that worked up. It's a recipe that I did a long time ago, and it actually came out better than I expected. So next week we'll do the recipe of the week or recipe of the month or something, and it's going to be a curry mead.
Oh, wow.
So those of you who want to try something a little bit quacko and out there, this will be the one for you to try.
There you go.
Sounds right up my alley. Yeah, I love curry. Yeah,
I concur.
Yeah, well, it's sort of a Thai curry mead, and it'll surprise, you know, it's not too bad. It's not the best mead I ever made, but it's you know, sometimes you make melomels, you make traditionals, you make sizers, and then you make them over again, and sometimes you just want to do something that's just different than everything else, and so this will be one of those meads that, you know, I'd suggest a 1 gallon batch, but it will sneak up on you.
You know, maybe we can even might even be able to get together on some of these do a recipe of the month, and you know, if we can all get the, you know, if it's clover honey or wildflower honey, we could all get together, do a batch, and compare notes, during the show as we go, and whatever the outcome is going to be. It'd be interesting to talk about the different flavors that each one of us might come up with. So that's something that we may, have a sideline on or a sidebar, and see if we can't get it worked out.
That'd be interesting.
I'll try to get healed up. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that would definitely be interesting to go back to the earlier point about just the variation in honey and ingredients from region to region across the country, you know, to see the ingredients that you're getting in Mississippi and out in California and then up here up north, just the variation in flavors that we get that way.
Chris doesn't have much of a selection of honey down where he's at. In Mississippi. Jeff, what are some of the varietals that you have around your area there in Kansas City?
Well, really, what I'm finding a lot more of than anything is wildflower and basic clover alfalfa honeys. Not really finding a lot from local beekeepers that I've talked to that have specific things like blueberry or fruit or something like that.
Do you live near an agricultural area, or?
I'm in the city, but the there's farmland all around the city, so.
Yeah.
And Jeff, don't discount a good clover honey. If you can, get your hands on a true white clover honey, you will be amazed at what it can do. Big difference from what you're going to go buy in the box stores. Find some real true clover, white clover honey. You'll be amazed at what you can do with it.
Yeah. A little wicker after something, yeah.
Yeah, see if you can find some white clover. Good stuff.
Well, now, Chris, is that the one that I've heard described as almost like a peppery type of a flavor?
It can have a peppery note. It can even have sort of a peppermint, minty type note. It can be quite zesty at times. It really comes through in certain melomels really well. It works good, and it makes a good traditional as well. So, I've heard it said before that, clover honey's a waste of time. Well, yeah, maybe most of the time it is, but it's because you haven't gotten any true good clover honey.
Yeah.
And I think, to my palate, I think white clover really stands above the others.
Well, I've gotten two buckets of that wildflower honey. Well, and obviously it's not the same. This bucket of wildflower honey doesn't anywhere come close to the same taste as the first bucket of wildflower that I got from my beekeeper. And that being said, both of them taste much different than the wildflower honey that you get out of the store. So, store-bought honey, box stores, like Chris calls them, I think for the most part, their honey is put through all kinds of pasteurization, heating, and, things are done to it to take, some of the flavor characteristics out of it. But, think you're absolutely right, Chris. I mean, if you can find a beekeeper, find a local source for some clover honey. I know a lot of people that make hard ciders use clover honey as well. Mm-hmm. I've seen that in a lot of recipes.
Yeah, and you mentioned that we didn't have a good selection down here. Actually, we've got probably the two most sought after honeys in the world. In here in the South, one is Tupelo, and the other is the Sourwood, which was voted, I think, the last 2 years in a row by the World Honey Association, or I don't know the correct name. It was voted the best honey in the world for 2 years in a row. I believe I'm correct on that. I know it was voted at least 1 year, and I think it was two. But so we do have those two honeys that are the most sought after in the world. The problem with our honey, as I've said before many times, we're blessed with a really good warm climate. And it's warm here, 300 and 25 days of the year.
Yeah.
So
rub it in.
So yeah, but you know, it's great for going swimming, but it's not so great when you've got that many. You know, anything that can grow grows here, and so every flower bed around here has got marigolds, which are the most bitter, vile thing you ever tasted. Mississippi is the magnolia state. We've got magnolia blossoms everywhere. The most beautiful smelling flower you've ever smelled. Absolutely awful in honey. So we've got lots of pasture land. So we've got a lot of milkweed. We've got a lot of bitterweed. We've got a lot of pasture thistle, which is very bitter. By the way, pasture thistle is a whole other world from star thistle. Star thistle is excellent honey. Pasture thistle, not so much. So if you get local honey from here, you're getting this huge, bitter, sour bomb. It's awful. It's great. It's great to put on your biscuits. It's wonderful table honey. You ferment that stuff down and it's just undrinkable.
Oh, wow.
And it always makes me jealous when I hear people talking from other parts of the country. They talk about, oh, we have the most wonderful local honey. Find your local beekeeper. And I tell everybody around here, avoid your local beekeeper because this is not what you want here. But it's just because of our climate. We, you know, so many things can grow here that just don't lend what I consider good qualities to honey for mead making. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Well, we're going to make every attempt at keeping this show at a 90-minute max time. Like that. Hey, you know what? If we don't get done talking about it tonight, we'll talk about it next week. I wanted to bring Jeff in here to talk about this experiment that he's working on. You know, I mean, this whole nutrient thing, I'm still kind of getting used to it. I'm not convinced that the typical, you know, nutrient thing that I'm doing, the Fermate K thing with the DAP and all that, I don't know that that's really the direction I need to be going. I'm more inclined, and I know Chris and I have talked about this offline, about this Tosna thing. Chris, I know, is pretty convinced about it. And Jeff, tell us what you're doing.
Well, you know, this started essentially from the same question. I'd been using DAP and Fermate K for a long time, and I'd heard a lot of really, really enthusiastic things about the Tosna, the Fermate O. So I kind of thought, well, is one necessarily any better than the other? And I kind of gathered some opinions on, you know, ways to handle the staggered nutrient additions and things like that. And let me preface this by saying, up until about a year ago, for the most part, my nutrient addition was just read the directions on the package and do that right at the start of fermentation.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I had very little finesse involved with this, so I started staggering things out a little bit, and I got some good results that way. So I kind of thought, well, you know, I should really find one way that I want to do this and that gives me the best results possible. So what I should do is basically start like a single 5-gallon batch and split that among some different possibilities. And so in terms of protocol and figuring out which ones I wanted to do, I found there was the Meat Maker podcast, not to pitch another podcast here, has their Batch Builder program. And that gives you, I believe, three different options, including like the Fermate K and the DAP and the Tosna. It's a very easy-to-use tool. So I plugged that in. I plugged in the concentration of my batch as far as 1120 significant gravity, and kind of went through all these different options, and then improvised a little bit from there to get another option that seemed to make more sense to me based on what I'd heard of Fermate O, because if the third option that I'm testing involves starting with Fermate-O and then finishing at Fermate-K and DAP, well, the from what I understood about Fermate-O is that it's more useful or more available in the latter stages of fermentation, so it would make more sense to me to finish with it. And so I did one that is essentially just taking that third option and flipping it backwards. And, of course, I have a control that's just following the directions on the package.
Right, yeah. And where are you at in this whole process now?
Well, I'm around about a week into this whole experiment, and I actually everything hit the one-third sugar break yesterday evening, so I've made all the final final additions to the meat, and it's kind of just waiting for things to differentiate out and see how things go from here.
And this is just a plain Jane, run-of-the-mill, traditional mead that you're making, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it's as basic as you can get. I used about, I want to say, 16, 17 pounds of big box honey and some D47 yeast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you another interesting thing you might want to try. This is actually what I had done for quite a while when I heard about Tosna before I finally made the leap to using Fermate-O. I followed the Tosna protocol, but I used only Fermate-K. And the only modification you have to make is in your calculations, rather than using 50 parts per million for the Fermate-O, use 100 parts per million for your Fermate-K.
And that makes sense. How? put that back down in English class. What does that mean?
go to Sergio's website, which is meadmaderight.
Are you kidding me? That's still Greek to me.
Well, essentially,
I'm an old country boy from Colorado. What the hell do I know about million?
Man, if a chicken farmer like me in Mississippi can do it, I know you can. You damn Yankees up in Colorado. And, I'll let Jeff explain it to you.
Well, essentially, from what I've been given to understand, the yeast available nitrogen in the Fermate-K is just at a higher concentration than the Fermate-O. So you get more... more of that nitrogen in the same amount of volume compared to Fermate-O.
You're talking about DAP, yeah, not yeast, DAP, right?
No, Fermate-K.
Yeah.
You got it?
Yeah, I got it, but I thought he said, I don't know. Maybe I heard it wrong, but I thought he said something about the yeast and the Fermate-K. But I thought you meant DAP.
Fermate-K has a small amount of DAP in it.
Yeah, that I knew. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, like if you want to get, let's say, if you want to get 300 parts per million, if you were using Fermate-O, you would divide by 50, so you would have 6 grams per gallon or whatever. Okay, so if you're doing Fermate-K, you would divide by 100 instead of 50, so you'd have 3 grams per gallon. So
that's my science teacher talking there. So he and I are going to get together sometime and talk about this. And Chris is one of the few people that I know of that can actually taste the DAP. I have no idea what it even tastes like, so I don't even know what to even look for. Can you?
It's a chemical taste. Yeah, it's a chemical taste, and by all theories on paper, I shouldn't be able to taste it, because if you use it in the correct amounts, it should be consumed by the yeast, and you shouldn't taste it. I can taste it. And I know that Michael Fairbrother at Moonlight Meadery can taste it as well. He and I have had this conversation before. so at least I know I'm not the only one. We may be the only two people in the world that can taste it, but it's offensive, and it's a chemical flavor. That's why I started getting away from it.
Yeah.
And I'm not 100% convinced yet that the use of DAP in excess, I think, contributes to hot alcohol formation. I can't prove that, but I do know from my experience that when I was using the standard DAP Firmaid K regimen, I was getting hot alcohol left and right. Since I got away from it, I'm drinking mead out of primary bucket. So, and enjoying it. Not flip to say it's lid. Not going to get better. It's going to get better.
Yeah, flip off lid, insert straw.
Yeah.
Well, and that was my experience too with this experiment that I've been working on. In the past, the nutrients that I've been using, I can't even tell you what they are. It's whatever the local homebrew supply shop sells with their mead kits. And, you know, one is your generic yeast nutrient and the other is the energizer. And I'm convinced it's the same thing you're talking about, Chris. It just puts off these fusel alcohols and hot flavors to it. And I just couldn't get over how smooth and clean these batches came out with the Firmaid O.
Mm-hmm. And it should be understood that they will get better, regardless of how good they are now. Any mead's going to get better with some age. But why put yourself through the wait when you can enjoy it perfectly well when it's, you know, a couple months old?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you think the ceiling's any higher, too? So, you know, one of these that produces a little more of those fusel alcohols, is the ceiling only so high with that, and it's only going to get so good after X number of years of aging, and these other ones just have a higher ceiling, do you think?
I wish I could tell you that, because mine doesn't, it never lasts long enough.
Doesn't last long enough. I could see that would be the case.
I've got a lot of alcoholic friends, and they don't really care. So as soon as I turn it out and get it bottled, it's gone. And so the oldest mead that I have right now is about 14 months old, and the only reason that I have it is because I hid it. And
there you go.
And it's still awesome. In the carboy. It's never been bottled. If it was bottled, it'd be gone.
Wow. We're talking,
and I'm not bragging. I don't want you to think I'm bragging and saying I make such great mead that everybody. No. It's not that. It's just that I have alcoholic friends.
Well, once you tie one on, anything you put in your mouth is kind of over and done with anyway, right?
Yeah, okay.
We're talking to Aaron Martin with us here tonight, Mississippi Chris from obviously Mississippi, Jeff Shrouse from Kansas City, Missouri. This is the Mead House. You can still call us, 818-921-4680. You can call us anytime during the show. We don't care. This is a very non-formal, you know, if you're looking to open a meadery, this is not the show you want to listen to. But if you're looking to make good mead before you open that meadery, this is the show that you need to be listening to. I mean, this is a show where we share different experiences. We talk about, you know, like we're doing tonight. I mean, this whole nutrient thing, Tosna, you know, I mean, it just runs the gamut. Yeah, and it's just, I mean, just good sitting around a table talking mead tonight here. One of the things, I got a friend who is a mead maker in Colorado. His name is Jim Davis. And when I was doing the other show, he caught on to my Rube Goldberg, which we'll get more into in upcoming shows. In fact, we'll just kind of have maybe a couple times a month do like a Rube Goldberg minute. He sent me an email here a few days back, or a week ago or so, and he's talking about wanting to put together a pump over system to degas and stir his mead. And I thought, what the hell is he talking about? And then he sent me a video, and I believe the one he sent me was actually from Melvino Meadery from Sergio Motella's place out there in New Jersey. And what they do is they use a pump, and they simply pump it from the bottom of the fermenter to the top of the fermenter. And it creates this wash in the, you know, inside the fermenter that, you know, actually does, you can kill two birds with one stone. I mean, you can degas and you can stir all at the same time.
And punch the cap down.
Yeah. So
if you're using fruit.
Yeah, exactly. So he's talking about wanting to build or at least look into, you know, putting something like this together. And I'm a big DIY fan, big time. You know, because you go out there and you price some of the equipment out there that, you know, you can build for $10. You can either buy it for $200 or build it for $10. I mean, what would you do? So the only thing that concerns me, and I don't know what you, you know, I mean, have you guys ever heard of a pump over system? You ever seen something like that before?
It's used in commercial production.
Yeah.
More so. And you know, I got to ask, what size batches is he making? Because I mean, I love all kinds of gadgets, and I'm certainly not opposed to it, but I got to ask, how feasible would it be, you know, when you got a 5 or 6 or 10 gallon batch, you, with a lee stir and a drill, you can pretty much do the job in 5 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think he's doing much more than 5 gallons. He didn't specify, but I think he's doing something around 5 gallons, 5 to 6 gallons. So, man, and that was my concern. I mean, my first thought is that even these wine pumps that you buy, they've got some pretty good velocity to them. And I mean, to rig it up to the top of your fermenter, I mean, I would just be afraid of this thing spewing out must like a fire hose. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it would probably serve to degas and maybe even aerate to some degree. Yeah. But I think in the commercial application, I think it's mostly used in punching down the fruit cap.
And the one that the one he did send a video that I did see, I'm sure it was from Melvino Meadery. I mean, it looks like they're actually using it just, you know, to stir the must. Of course, you only want to do that in the beginning. You certainly don't want to do that afterwards, because you don't want to introduce any oxygen. You know, once you're past, you know, about what, the 1/3 break?
Maybe 50%.
Yeah.
At the most.
Yeah. So after a certain point, it would seem to me like it would almost become useless to have something like that. However.
And what was his name?
Jim Davis.
Well, Jim, I don't see the use particularly in a small batch, but if you want a design for it, we'll come up with one for you.
Yeah. Well, he sent me some links to some wine pumps. He's talking about using a diaphragm pump, which was another concern. I mean, you would have to use something, you know, food grade type pump. You can't use anything with exposed bearings or anything like that. But it would be a fun, it sounds like a fun project to play around with. I may get involved with this. But there's a second use for it also, and that's to use it as a transfer system as well. I have a vacuum system that I use, and it works like a champ. I can't be more thrilled, and it's, you know, pretty much a, I might have maybe $30 invested in this whole thing, and I can transfer 5 gallons, 1 gallons. It doesn't matter the size. And we'll put that up on the Mead House website as well, the plans for it. And the
leaves. That's what you use. You use that to rack your meads too, don't you?
Yep. I use that to rack my meads. I have arthritis pretty bad in both hands, and I've broken every frickin' glass in the house. So it's difficult for me to pick these damn heavy carboys up because I'm afraid I'm just going to drop them. So I had to come up with something, and I saw a couple examples on YouTube, and I thought, so I just gathered up all the parts, the hardware store, Amazon.com, and built this vacuum system racking pump, and it works like a champ. I mean, it makes use of my racking. I just stick the racking cane down in your muss just like you would anyway. Except it, you know, the other end goes into the empty carboy, and then the capper that goes on to the empty carboy is sealed. It has another hole in it for the vacuum tube, and you just simply create the vacuum inside the glass carboy, and it will suck the must up from your fermenter right into your carboy. So I don't have to pick anything up. It's tabletop compatible, and it works like a champ. So,
yeah, and versatile too, because I'm sure with a little ingenuity, you can figure out a way to reverse that and use it maybe to vacuum degas as well.
Actually, I am doing that, and all it takes is a bung. Just a regular bung and a valve. I put a valve on mine, and you just simply hook the hose up, the tubing up from the suction line to the top of the bung. Now you might have to play around with some fittings and sizes and everything to get the correct fit. It doesn't take much, I can tell you that. And just simply put the bung on top of the carboy and turn your pump on.
Mm-hmm.
You have
I was using a food saver to vacuum degas, and I was having a lot of trouble getting a good seal, but finally got that figured out. And trying to use an oversized tube to go in the bung, and you know, you can't get it in there. I tried hot water, and finally I did, you know, what I, in my twisted way of thinking, I did what seemed like the right thing. I got some Astroglide and put on it. You know, awesome. I mean, we're putting something in the bung, so yeah. Let's get some Astroglide. And sealed it right off and vacuum degassed it and yeah. Worked like a charm. But then if you start getting any kind of foam, then you clog up your food saver.
Well, so, okay, so what you need to do is put a blow-off jar in between, and it's simply another part that I got from Amazon.com. It's a whole house filter, water filter canister, and you get it. It has you can get a quarter inch, you can get a 3/8. I got 3/8 fittings on it. You put 3/8 barbs on the intake and the outtake. And you put that between your vacuum line so that if you do suck any liquid,
just in line.
Right, it'll go into the canister before it goes into the pump.
Right.
So,
we can figure stuff out on, you know.
Absolutely. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of Rube Goldberg. I mean, I have duct tape and baling wired stuff on the farm together. I mean, I've held John Deere tractors together with nothing more than baling wire and driven them down the road to the mechanic to get it fixed. You know what I mean? So
yeah, well, duct tape is like the force, man. It has a light side and a dark side, and it holds the universe together.
I like it.
Jeff, have you ever you use anything like that, or ever think of doing something like that at all?
Well, you know, that vacuum tube does sound really interesting. I would love to see plans for that. not really a lot of Rube Goldberging yet. I'm kind of in the process of converting an old refrigerator into a temperature control, but that's about the extent of my Rube Goldberging so far.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
So that's going to be the best move you ever made. Trust me.
Yeah, Chris has got one that he's converted.
Yeah. I actually found a little dorm room refrigerator that my bucket fits in perfectly. Yeah, that's going to be the best move you ever made. How many times, JD, have I said I didn't start making good mead until I got control of my fermentation temperatures?
Yeah. Yeah,
it makes all the difference.
That's probably worthy of another show too. I mean, this whole thing, and you know, I mean, I don't know how you know, Jeff and Aaron started. I mean, I just, you know, we talked about earlier how many gallons upon gallons of mead that I fed to the garbage disposal and tried to pass off to my neighbors until they thought I was trying to poison them. But you know, I mean, until you know, and here again, I mean, the mistake, I mean, Jeff, I mean, let me ask you, when you first started making mead, were you like me? Did you go out, you found all these recipes on all these websites and you know, go out, buy the yeast, the honey, and throw it together and hope for the best?
A little bit, yeah. To be honest, I didn't do a lot of research on the web. I found Ken Schramm's book, and I found a recipe at my local homebrew store. Oh. And after talking to another mead maker that I met at a Renaissance fair a couple years beforehand, I kind of had this full notion that making mead was easy. So
it is.
It can be as complicated as you want to make it, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
It's easy. It's just expensive.
You have
two stories.
When, you know, I mean, I was kind of stupid because I thought Google was like the answer to everything. So I went out to Google and I asked Google, hey, show me some mead recipes. Teach me about mead. Well, it spit out these recipes that, you know, like I said in the beginning. You know, people post this stuff up, 3 pounds of wildflower honey, you know, a gallon of water and some, you know, 11-18 yeast. And you just throw it all in the thing and shake the shit out of it. I'm sorry, shake the crap out of it. Hey, you know what? The FCC doesn't live here. You shake the garbage out of it, okay, and aerate it, and then you put an airlock on it and go away for a month. And that's how I started. You know, I mean, they say nothing about temperature control, nothing about nutrients, none of that kind of stuff, you know. Yeah, that's
the question. Any new listeners, let's make this very clear. This is sort of our introduction show. This is where we just kind of we're going to get into some very detailed things in the weeks to come. We're going to get into some instructional type conversations, and so this is our introduction show, and so we're talking about a lot of different things here, I know, but rest assured, we're going to be getting some recipes up. We're going to be discussing all these things in detail, that, you know, these beginning techniques, basic techniques, and then some advanced techniques as well. So
yeah,
stay tuned.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, this is the first one that's going to go in the can. And I gotta say, though, I messed up the beginning of the show. What's going in the can? We actually pick up Chris when we introduce Chris, and Chris starts talking. The battery in my mouth. And this, and I skipped over the whole what are we drinking thing, Aaron.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of that. You know what I was doing? I was frantically trying to put frickin' batteries in my mouth. And I couldn't. When I went to click on the encoder, the recording encoder, to start recording the show, nothing happened.
Oh, you're kidding.
So I'm sitting here talking. And I'm trying to put batteries in the mouse. And anyway, so I got the batteries in. We got the show recorded. We pick up Chris after the introduction. So we skip right over the whole half of the frickin' introduction. But anyway, so, but hey, you know what? This is free radio, you know? Nobody's paying us to do this.
So if they're not happy, they can get their money back.
Yeah.
There you go.
But I promise we will do better. You know, we'll certainly do better. And, you know, this is commercial free. There's no advertising here. Like I said, simply this is just three, possibly four, if I can convince Jeff to come on with us. Just sitting around a table talking mead and various degrees of experience. Which I think pays off big time because we all learn from each other.
Jeff mentioned something about a moment ago. He mentioned the Mead Makers podcast. And let me just say this. We're not in competition with anybody. No. The mead industry, although it's been around for thousands and thousands of years, it's just now reemerging, and it's on a teeter-totter right now. And it can either take off like a rocket or it can crash and burn. And the quickest way to make it crash and burn is for us to be secretive with our knowledge, or, you know, the way that we make this thing take off. We, the home brewers, we are the heart of meat making right now. It's the home brewers that are bringing it back. And then the really good home brewers are moving on to the commercial side, and they're really pushing to bring it back. If we stick together, we help each other out. That's what this is all about. You know, it was the search for knowledge that brought us all together, but it was the friendship that kept us here. So, share your knowledge. Be free with it. We're not in competition. I listen to the Mead Makers, and, you know, they have some good stuff on. I listen to everybody. If there's a dozen podcasts on about mead making, I'll be listening to them. So let's all come together and let's share our knowledge and help each other out and make better mead.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, couldn't agree more.
I like it. The way I would say it is I'm just a fan of the other shows out there, and the more the merrier. So the more people out there talking mead, the better for the movement.
Well, yeah, and everybody's show is recorded, so pick one to listen to live, or, you know, listen, download the rest, or download them all. I mean, shoot, there's no common. This is, you know, we're not catering to a million listeners here. It's not the Academy Awards.
No.
And we're all here to help each other. So,
yeah,
the more the merrier.
Somebody once told me here a while back that, you know, they said podcasts were dead, that, they served its purpose and they're really kind of pointless. Until you go to iTunes and go to their podcast library, and there's literally thousands and thousands of podcasts on any given subject except making mead. There's only a couple of them out there. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to be involved with two of them so far. This is the second one. And, you know, like you say, Chris, I mean, this is an emerging industry. There is relatively little data out there that you can point a finger to and say, yeah, this is what we need to be doing. Hell, everything they know about mead, they got from making wine. I mean, we're still using yeast that are specifically made to ferment wine, ferment grapes. And we're doing our best to try to come up with, you know, what works good with what honeys and what works good with what styles of mead as far as yeast goes using the wine yeast. So until they get
to... And it's homebrewers that are doing that. It's people like Jeff and Aaron and you and myself. We're the ones that are... we're the ones pouring the failed batches down the drain and saying, you know, mark that one off the list. That don't work.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so.
Jeff, what do you think, bud? Can you do you think you'd like to be a part of this show on a regular basis, or up to you?
Well, let me talk it over with the wife. I think I would enjoy that, but, you know, got to make sure the schedule lines up correctly here.
Yeah, I got to, you know, everything I do, I got to check in with the boss, too. So. Don't we all?
Well, mine has total control over me right now because I'm in a chair, so.
You don't have too many bargaining chips right now, do you, Chris?
I have no bargaining chips right now.
Yeah, I sent Chris a text the other day, and what I got back sat me right up in my chair, and I'm thinking, holy crap. I didn't know whether to call. It had just happened, and come to find out that Chris was involved in this terrible auto accident out there in Mississippi, and wow, really kind of set me back a little bit there. But Chris is doing all right.
I will. You can't keep a redneck down, no matter how hard you try. So we find a way.
Well, you know, Jeff, I'm anxious to hear more about your experiment. It's these kind of things that you and Aaron are doing to, you know, help write the white paper or the data sheets out there that, you know, kind of the been there, done that thing. Here's the result. That gets down, gets recorded somewhere, whether it's passed off on a Facebook page or on somebody's website or someplace, at least it's knowledge for other people out there to learn from, to use, to say, hey, you know, don't try that. This guy tried it, and this is the result. So, and that's kind of where it's at for us, you know.
Yeah, it really is the home league makers that are the innovators in this field, and that's part of what makes it such an exciting hobby.
Yeah.
Well,
we need to hear about Aaron's other two meads too. You talked about the cranberry and the sunflower. We need to hear about your other two as well. Another point to make real quick on Aaron's little experiment there. If you want to learn how to compare these honeys and see what kind of mead they're going to make, always keep some of the honey with your batch of mead. And once that mead has settled out and cleared, and then you can get a realistic taste of what it's going to be like, then go back and taste your honey along with it and see if you can connect those flavors.
That is a great suggestion. Do a side-by-side taste comparison. And I saved a little small amount of each of the honeys with the intention that, you know, if they fermented too bone dry, that I could back sweeten a little bit. But I think I'm going to withhold on doing that and plan on doing that honey flavor comparison to the finished mead.
You just gave new purpose to a crap load of little jelly jars I've got in the closet. Aaron, we need to start a page on the website, I guess, for our notes, these kind of things, things that we'd learned talking to each other on the show. That's a hell of a good idea, and why I didn't think of that before is beyond me, but that makes total sense to me. I wished I had some of that orange blossom honey that I used when I put that first big batch of mine together. I wish I had some of that to taste right now as I'm drinking my mead. It might have made a whole lot more sense as to what I was tasting and smelling and that kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's a great thing. It's a great way to compare. And if you do that enough, you will eventually get to the point where you can say, okay, I see now where this flavor is coming from. You know, when you strip away that sweetness, what you're left with is the backbone of the honey. And, you know, you can start to recognize it. And it's finding the correct words to describe it is sometimes difficult for me. I know what I'm tasting. I just don't know how to describe it. And that comes from I'm getting a lot of help from that by reading tasting notes from professional tasters and from people who are professional BJCP judges and things like that in competitions. If you read their tasting notes, you start to pick up this vocabulary, and then when you smell it or when you taste it, you go, okay, now I see where that's coming from. You see, I never associated a tart apple flavor with honey until I read some tasting notes on sourwood. I went and got some of my sourwood honey, and I tasted it, and it was right in front of my face. You know, it was like, that's it. It's apple. That's what I'm tasting.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it just takes a little imagination and reading, and all of a sudden it just jumps out at you. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I think we're at 0 hour, aren't we? Gosh, my house
went by fast.
Yeah, it did. Am I looking at the clock right? Is it like 10:30 Eastern?
Looks like it's about it. I got some hydrocodone calling my name.
Well, Chris managed to stick it out for the full 90 minutes. Wow, Chris.
Yeah, tipping the cap to you, sir.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm there.
And,
I'm pleased to pop a few now.
Big thanks to Jeff Strauss for, you know, joining us here tonight. And we're going to see if we can't get Jeff on as a regular here to join the party. The Mead House show every Tuesday night at 9 o'clock right here on themeadhouse.com. That's where you can listen to it. And again, we're going to have in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have our own very own Mead House apps that will launch the show. You can take us mobile if you'd like. We have no Facebook, no Twitter, just a website, and that's how it's going to roll here at themeadhouse.com. So with that, we're going to return you back to your regular scheduled programming. Enjoy the music. In the meantime, we'll probably do just a little bit of an after party here as we put Chris to bed. So we'll see you next week.
So long.
Have a good one.